This is the TED Radio Hour. Each week, groundbreaking TED Talks.
TED Talks.
TED.
TED.
Technology.
Entertainment.
Design.
Design. Is that really what it stands for? I've never known that.
Delivered at TED conferences around the world.
It's the gift of the human imagination.
We've had to believe in impossible things.
The true nature of reality beckons from just beyond.
Those talks, those ideas, adapted for radio. From NPR. I'm Guy Raz. So about 20 years ago, millions of people heard this voice for the very first time.
Good morning, day one. Walking to school. Leaving out your door. This is my dog, Ferocious. You know why he got that name if you hear him bark.
The boy in this recording is Lee Allen Jones. He was 13 at the time. It was 1993, and he lived in one of the most violent neighborhoods on Chicago's South Side. A local public radio station gave Lee Allen and a friend tape recorders to make a documentary about their lives. The music you're hearing, by the way, is part of that documentary. And it was called Ghetto Life 101.
I see the ghetto every day, walking to school.
And it was basically half an hour of this kid, Lee Allen.
My name's Lee Allen Jones, and I'm 13 years old.
And his friend, Lloyd.
This is Lloyd Newman, and I'm 14 years old.
Just walking through a normal week in their lives.
This is our story.
It was such a simple idea, and yet in 1993, this was totally new. First-person storytelling from two African-American teenagers.
We've been friends since first grade.
That's 7 years.
I was interested in the idea of people having the chance to be listened to and tell their stories.
Dave Isay was the producer behind Ghetto Life 101, but he actually doesn't appear in the documentary at all because Dave wanted Lee Allen and Lloyd to tell their own stories.
We're both in eighth grade. When I was 10, I seen my first automatic weapon, a Glock 9.
I seen all kinds of stuff.
Now, today, a lot of public radio shows and podcasts are about listening to incredible stories from ordinary people. But Dave Isay was one of the very first to do this kind of work.
Part of what I was trying to do in these documentaries is that I always found that my voice, if I was there, it kind of pulled you out of this place. And what I was trying to do is have people go to a place where they felt like they were very connected to whoever was talking.
And that led to things that you would never hear in a traditional documentary. Things like the moment when Lee Allen interviews his mom and just asks her in this incredibly casual way.
Who is my father?
Your father is a fella named Toby Flipper. He's saying he know you exist. He's saying you when you was about 2, and I ain't seen him since.
What do you think happened to him?
He probably dead.
Thank you.
Okay.
And then there's also this moment when Lee Allen interviews his grandma, and she loved gospel music.
And of all the songs she knows, the one she loves the most is called One Day at a Time. Could you please sing that song for us?
Well, my voice all messed up.
Do it. 1, 2, 1, 2, 3.
Do you remember when you walked among men?
Listening to a recording like this is a way, in a sense, to learn something from someone born in a different time or a different place.
Lee Allen often says that everything he needs to know in life is contained in those recordings of his grandmother.
One day at a time.
She was hoarse, but she still can blow. Thank you.
You know, hearing a story from someone who you might have thought was very different than you on the radio, in the car, with your headphones on, and recognizing a little bit of yourself in that person has tremendous potential to build bridges of understanding between people and hopefully someday to move the needle on helping us recognize the power and grace and beauty in the stories we'll find all around us when we take the time to listen.
Our show today is all about that, all about listening, and ideas about what we can learn when we listen to people and to places that are almost never heard. Listening as an act of generosity, and also a path to discovery. Later in the show, the story of how Dave Isay created a project dedicated to this idea. You might have heard of it. It's called StoryCorps, which is now working to give people everywhere a new way to listen to each other.
Imagine, for example, a national homework assignment where every high school student studying U.S. history across the country records an interview with an elder over Thanksgiving so that in one single weekend, an entire generation of American lives and experiences are captured.
Dave Isay's TED Talk and his plan to do that coming up. But right now, a kind of listening that is a little less terrestrial. So are you hearing this?
Yep.
So what is this?
This is the sound of cosmic microwave background radiation left over from the Big Bang 13.78 billion years ago.
Wow. We're hearing the Big Bang right now?
You're hearing what's left of the Big Bang. It's the closest that we can come to experiencing the beginning of the universe.
This is Honor Harger. She's a sound artist. And a few years ago, Honor started to listen to space. Because while most of us could tell you what space looks like, not a lot of people could tell you what it sounds like. Here's how Honor explained it from the TED stage.
Now, this story doesn't start with vast telescopes or futuristic spacecraft, but a rather more humble technology. And in fact, the very medium which gave us the telecommunications revolution that we're all part of today, the telephone. It's 1876, it's in Boston, and this is Alexander Graham Bell, who was working with Thomas Watson on the invention of the telephone. A key part of their technical setup was a half-mile-long length of wire, which was thrown across the rooftops of several houses in Boston. The line carried the telephone signals that would later make Bell a household name. But like any long length of charged wire, it also inadvertently became an antenna. Thomas Watson spent hours listening to the strange crackles and hisses and chirps and whistles that his accidental antenna detected. So what were these strange noises? As he correctly guessed, some of these sounds were caused by activity on the surface of the sun. So, whilst inventing the technology that would usher in the telecommunications revolution, Watson had discovered that the star at the center of our solar system emitted powerful radio waves. He had accidentally been the first person to tune into them.
Yeah, it's crazy because we think about space as a silent place. Like, we don't think of space as having anything to hear.
Well, in a sense, that's accurate because the medium of space itself is a vacuum. And, you know, obviously sound can't travel in a vacuum, but it's the fact that radio waves can travel through the vacuum of space and then be detected using the same types of radio receivers and antennas that our listeners are using to detect our voices. That's where the magic is really happening here. Because, you know, scaling up those antennas and changing the frequency of those receivers makes it possible for us to detect not just radio waves made by us here on Earth, but celestial radio waves made by the sun or Jupiter or a pulsar or any other astrophysical phenomena.
So, but what if you're just like out there in space, right? Like, what is that empty sound, like that empty space sound like?
Well, the sound of space itself sounds a bit like an undifferentiated hissing noise.
Just like a
pretty much.
Yeah.
And it's not until you're actually, you know, listening to a particular object. So different objects sound like different things. Jupiter sounds like ocean waves breaking up on a beach if it's long waves of radiation. Pebbles being thrown onto a tin roof if it's short waves of radiation. The sun sounds a little bit like the sea, kind of roaring. A pulsar, for instance, which is a pulsating radio star, sounds like a drum beat. The faster the pulsar is spinning, the faster the beat. You become quite attuned to being able to detect what it is that you're listening to just by the sounds.
It's through listening that we've come to uncover some of the universe's most important secrets. Its scale, what it's made of, and even how old it is. This is what the sun sounds like. This is the planet Jupiter. This is a highly condensed clump of neutral matter spinning in the distant universe.
When you hear those sounds, what are they telling us about space?
So one of the practices of turning a non-audible phenomena into sound is trying to work out if there's something that we can hear in the data that we can't see. And sometimes ears can be incredibly effective detectors of patterns in a way that perhaps our eyes, because we use them so much more, are not as effective at. So I suppose that's the scientific answer. And then the human or artistic answer is that there's something quite emotionally fulfilling about being able to connect with something as distant and therefore quite abstract as a star through the emotional mechanism of listening. These vastly, you know, kind of large astrophysical structures become a little bit more tangible to us, I think, if we can approach them through listening as opposed to just looking.
Honor Harger is a sound artist and now the executive director of the Art Science Museum in Singapore. In a moment, listening with your whole body, I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey everyone, quick thanks to two of our sponsors who help keep this podcast going. First to Wistia. It's a video hosting platform built specifically for business. If you're using video as a part of your marketing strategy, you need to be able to measure its impact. And Wistia is helping over 175,000 businesses do just that with premium video hosting, lead generation tools, and in-depth video analytics. Wistia believes that anyone can make awesome video for their business, even with a GoPro. So for your chance to win one, visit wistia.com/NPR. Also thanks to Citrix with GoToWebinar, where you can create captivating events that fuel marketing success. GoToWebinar makes it easy to expand your reach, influence the right people, and increase your lead flow. I have no idea what that means, but I think it's pretty important. You just need the right business tools. With GoToWebinar, you can create interactive online events that help you engage and capture your audience's attention. You can find out more at GoToWebinar.com.
It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. On the show today, listening as an act of generosity and listening as a source of discovery.
Shall I do another level?
Yes, if you could please.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, ABC, percussion, percussion, drums, marimba, 1, 2, 1, 2.
All right, so first of all, can you introduce yourself, please?
My name is Evelyn Glennie. I am a solo percussionist, and therefore I go around the world giving solo percussion concerts.
Evelyn is, in fact, one of the best-known percussionists in the world.
You're hearing some of her music right now. She's won major prizes, she's played with the top orchestras, and when she spoke with us from a studio in the UK, sitting right next to Evelyn. Hello, Maria.
Hi, Guy.
Evelyn's friend, Maria, who is repeating my part of the conversation so that Evelyn can lip read, because she is almost entirely deaf. And she started to go deaf when she was a kid, but she can still perform with incredible precision and amazing sensitivity. So the question is, how?
Well, that's a huge question, and it's actually a very broad question. So it's always allowing the body, and I would say also the eye, to be the two main factors. So rather than depending on what the ear is telling you and you're reliant on that, in fact, I'm basically, you know, or I have discovered that, heavens above, you know, sound is vibration, and that can feed through the entire body. So in a way, I see the body as a big ear.
Here's Evelyn demonstrating that on the TED stage with a marimba and a set of mallets.
My aim really is to teach the world to listen. That's my only real aim in life. We have to listen to ourselves, first of all. I remember when I was 12 years old and I started playing timpani and percussion, and my teacher said, well, how are we going to do this? You know, music is about listening. How are you going to hear this? How are you going to hear that? And I said, well, how do you hear it? He said, well, I think I hear it through here. And I said, well, I think I do too, but I also hear it through my hands, through my arms, my cheekbones, my scalp, my tummy, my chest, my legs, and so on. And so we began our lessons every single time tuning drums, in particular the kettle drums or timpani, to such a narrow pitch interval. So something like that of a difference. And then gradually, and gradually. And it's amazing that when you do open your body up and open your hand up to allow the vibration to come through, that in fact the tiny, tiny difference can be felt with just the tiniest part of your finger there. And together we would listen to the sounds of the instruments, the type of sticks. Etc., etc. They're all different. Same amount of weight, but different sound colors.
How are you able to feel those differences between two different kinds of mallets? I mean, it seems like that would be really hard.
Yes. I mean, sometimes the differences are extremely subtle indeed, but if I'm using very, very soft mallets where the wool is quite loosely wound around the head, you know, you won't get the attack so much, but you're much more prepared to listen to the resonance of the sounds. If I'm using really hard sticks, well, those are like bullets in a way. The feeling will come much higher up in the body, from about the chest, the neck, the cheekbones, and so on. And it's much more of a sharp attack.
And when you play a really resonant note, you actually feel that note long after most people feel that note, because you're sort of attuned, your body is attuned to experiencing it that way.
Yes, very often, you know, if I'm playing a big bass drum or something, I mean, I can see the actual drum skin resonate, you know, you really can. You can see it going up and down. And it's interesting because in my early years, I found that a lot of the sounds that I now appreciate, I really didn't appreciate early on. So a lot of the gold-like sounds, so cymbals and triangles, glockenspiels, tubular bells, because I was feeding them through the ear, it just completely distorted everything and was quite painful. But actually, it's those sounds that I disliked early on that really do resonate in the body and I really hang on to because I've managed to just physically open myself up. As I grew older, I then auditioned for the Royal Academy of Music in London. And they said, well, no, we won't accept you because we haven't a clue of the future of a so-called deaf musician. I just couldn't quite accept that. And so therefore, I said to them, well, look, if you refuse me through those reasons, as opposed to the ability to perform and to understand and love the art of creating sound, then we have to think very, very hard about the people you do actually accept. And once we got over a little hurdle and having to audition twice, they accepted me. And not only that, it changed the whole role of the music institutions throughout the United Kingdom. And every single entry had to be listened to, experienced, and then based on the musical ability, that person could either enter or not. And so therefore, there was an extremely interesting bunch of students who arrived in these various music institutions, many of them now in the professional orchestras throughout the world.
What is it that people who have their full ability to hear, what is it that you think they don't quite understand about listening and hearing?
Well, I mean, we're all so different, but I know that when I was losing my hearing, you know, it was a confusing time because, of course, I thought that all sound was fed through the ears. And therefore, I thought I needed volume, you know, I needed loudness in order to hear. So with hearing people, of course, there's sound everywhere and you can't get rid of that. Well, sometimes you try to by putting more sound into your system using earphones and whatever else, but that's just then overload.
Yeah, and there's so many dimensions to this because different people listen in different ways.
Yes, and it's interesting because sometimes, you know, if I'm with sight-impaired people and I give them an instrument, you know, the first thing they do is to spend a good time literally feeling that instrument before any sound is being produced. Whereas, you know, when you give most people a handheld instrument or something, immediately it's bang, 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 you know. And it was quite fascinating because then suddenly when the youngsters did in their own time decide to make a sound, we were already paying attention to them, sort of ready, waiting for that sound and wondering what that sound would be. So they had created this wonderful emotion and really created that palette of listening. And ultimately, listening is about paying attention, it's about focusing, and it's about concentration.
Evelyn Glennie, she's a percussionist and recording artist, and she just won the 2015 Polar Music Prize. It's an award given to pop and classical musicians. You can see her entire performance from this TED Talk at TED.com. So up to this point, we've been mainly hearing about how listening is an act of discovery. But what about when it's mainly an act of empathy? What happens when we listen to people that are rarely, if ever, heard? So the story begins back in the mid-1980s. Jeffrey Brown was a young minister, and his first congregation was at the Union Baptist Church near Boston. And while the church was a pretty peaceful place, what was going on just outside its walls was anything but. It's a story he told on the TED stage.
In my city and in the entire metro area, and in most metro areas in the United States, the homicide rate started to rise precipitously. It got to the point where it started to change the character of the city. You could go to any housing project, for example, like the one that was down the street from my church, and you'd walk in and it would be like a ghost town because the parents wouldn't allow their kids to come out and play, even in the summertime, because of the violence. And so I started to preach the crying, the violence in the community. And I started to look at the programming in my church, and I started to build programs that would catch the at-risk youth, you know, those who are on the fence to the violence. But I preached, and I built these programs, and I thought maybe if my colleagues did the same, that it would make a difference. But the violence just careened out of control, and I didn't know what to do. And then something happened that changed everything for me. It's a kid by the name of Jesse McKee, walking home with his friend Rigoberto Carrion to the housing project down the street from my church. They met up with a group of youth who were from a gang in Dorchester, and they were killed. But as Jesse was running from the scene mortally wounded, he was running in the direction of my church. He died some 100, 150 yards away. If he would have gotten to the church, it wouldn't have made a difference because the lights were out. Nobody was home. And I took that as a sign.
You took that as a sign that, I guess, that you had to change the way you were going about this.
No, absolutely. I mean, a paradox started to emerge inside of me. And the paradox was this: if I really wanted the community that I was preaching for, that I had to redefine my own sense of community and reach out and embrace these young people that I had cut out. And that meant that rather than trying to draw young people who are at risk to violence into the confines of the church, that I needed to reach out and embrace these young men who were committing the acts of violence. So it was the drug dealers and the gangbangers and those who were out there on the street.
So I started to walk the streets at night, late at night. And there was a small cadre of us who came to the realization that we had to come out of the four walls of our sanctuary and meet the youth where they were and not try to figure out how to bring them in. So we decided to walk together. And we would get together in one of the most dangerous neighborhoods in the city on a Friday night and on a Saturday night at 10 p.m. And we'd walk till 2 or 3 in the morning. I imagine we were quite the anomaly when we first started walking. I mean, you know, we weren't drug dealers, we weren't drug customers, we weren't the police. Some of us would have collars on. It was probably a really odd thing. But they started speaking to us after a while. And as we were talking with them, a number of myths were dispelled about them with us. And one of the biggest myths was that these kids were cold and heartless and uncharacteristically bold in their violence. What we found out was the exact opposite. Most of the young people who are out there on the streets are just trying to make it on the streets. And we also found out that some of the most intelligent and creative, magnificent, and wise people that we've ever met were on the street, engaged in a struggle. And as a result of that, we said to them, how do you see this church? How do you see this institution helping this situation?
I mean, we would ask them, you know, we don't know our own neighborhoods after 9 p.m. at night, but you do. Talk to us, you know, tell us what we're not seeing. And then, admittedly, we did something that is difficult for preachers sometimes, which is to listen and not preach.
What came out of that, from listening to those people, was a citywide program that led to a 79% drop in homicides over the next decade. It became known as the Boston Miracle. It's since been replicated in dozens of cities around the country. And basically, the program made people like Jeffrey Brown mediators in their communities. They worked with other leaders in the neighborhood and with prosecutors and probation officers to reach out to gang members. They'd offer them more support in schools, maybe access to jobs. The police were focused more on supporting the program and less on arresting people.
So when you have the police, probation officers, community leaders, faith leaders, the youth out on the streets, able to be in dialogue with one another and build relationships with each other, you know, I think we were able to actually, you know, make a huge difference.
The Boston Miracle was about bringing people together. But there is this political ploy to try to pit police brutality and police misconduct against black-on-black violence. But it's a fiction. When you think about decades of failed housing policies and poor educational structures, when you think about persistent unemployment and underemployment in a community, when you think about poor health care, and then you throw drugs into the mix and duffel bags full of guns, little wonder that you would see this culture of violence emerge. And then the response that comes from the state is more cops and more suppression of hotspots. It's all connected. And one of the wonderful things that we've been able to do is to be able to show that the solution is not more cops, but the solution is mining the assets there in the community.
When you preach and you are delivering a sermon, it is more or less a one-way stream of information. I mean, you get feedback from the congregation, but it's
I'm in the black church now. You know, we get a lot of feedback.
Right. But the information is coming from you to the congregation. And you point this out, that being a preacher is normally, they're not normally listening.
Yep.
But I wonder what you have learned about listening. Has your sort of perspective on listening changed?
Yes, it has. By listening to the young people, I discovered that I didn't have all the answers. But in the dialogue that occurs, you find that there is a magnetism where you come together in a way that is greater than the sum of its parts, if you will.
Yeah.
And by listening, you find yourselves drawn into this greater presence where you can find answers that may not be audible answers, but it's something that you feel in your spirit.
Reverend Jeffrey Brown, he's the president of RECAP. It's a group that works around the country to help reduce gang violence. You can see his full talk at ted.npr.org. Our show today, The Act of Listening, I'm Guy Raz, and this is the TED Radio Hour from NPR. Hey, just a quick thanks to one of our sponsors, Dropbox. Dropbox is trusted by people in over 4 million businesses worldwide to keep their files safe, synced, and easy to share with anyone. Dropbox for Business helps team members work together no matter where they are or what tools they use. To find out more and try it free, go to dropbox.com/NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on today's show, The Act of Listening. And earlier, we introduced you to a guy named Dave Isay. Dave is a pioneering radio producer with an idea to give people all over the world a brand new way to listen to each other. And this year, that idea earned him the $1 million TED Prize. It's an award given each year to someone with a vision to change part of the world. But the story of how Dave came up with that idea actually started years ago. It was in the late 1980s. Dave was 22, and he was just starting out in radio. And it's a story he told on the TED stage.
At almost the exact same time, I found out that my dad, who I was very, very close to, was gay. I was taken completely by surprise. We were a very tight-knit family, and I was crushed. At some point in one of our strained conversations, my dad mentioned the Stonewall riots. He told me that one night in 1969, a group of young black and Latino drag queens fought back against the police at a gay bar in Manhattan called the Stonewall Inn, and how this sparked the modern gay rights movement. It was an amazing story, and it piqued my interest. So I decided to pick up my tape recorder and find out more. With the help of a young archivist named Michael Shirker, we tracked down all of the people we could find who had been at the Stonewall Inn that night.
I guess, as they say, or as Shakespeare says, we were ladies in waiting, just waiting for the thing to happen.
Recording these interviews, I saw how the microphone gave me the license to go places I otherwise never would have gone and talk to people I might not otherwise ever have spoken to.
There was a cop and is on his stomach with a drag queen straddling him. She was beating the hell out of him with her shoe. Whether it was a high heel or not, I don't know. But she was beating the hell out of him.
I had the privilege of getting to know some of the most amazing, fierce, and courageous human beings I had ever met. It was the first time the story of Stonewall had been told to a national audience.
This was a tremendous thing that had happened at Stonewall, and it gave us a feeling that we were not going to be closeted for very much longer.
I dedicated the program to my dad. It changed my relationship with him, and it changed my life.
By doing that, by listening to those people, was it sort of a way for you to kind of communicate with your dad?
Oh, totally. You know, it was taking steps towards him. And also, I think what I wanted to do was understand what he had gone through. And I wasn't at the place where I could talk to him about it yet. But talking to these men and women about, you know, what life was like, especially in the era before Stonewall, and the hiding and the shame and pain, you know, that's where I learned everything.
Over the next 15 years, I made many more radio documentaries, working to shine a light on people who are rarely heard from in the media. Over and over again, I'd see how the simple act of being interviewed could mean so much to people, particularly those who'd been told that their stories didn't matter. I could literally see people's backs straighten as they started to speak into the microphone. In 1998, I made a documentary about the last flophouse hotels on the Bowery in Manhattan. Guys stayed up in these cheap hotels for decades. They lived in cubicles the size of prison cells covered with chicken wire so you couldn't jump from one room into the next. Later, I wrote a book on the men with the photographer Harvey Wang. I remember walking into a flophouse with an early version of the book and showing one of the guys his page. He stood there staring at it in silence. Then he grabbed the book out of my hand and started running down the long, narrow hallway, shouting, "I exist. I exist."
We don't think about listening as this profound act of respect, like really giving somebody dignity or a gift, especially people who are not listened to or not heard from.
That's right. And that's always been kind of the guiding lessons of the last, you know, 30 years. I mean, we all have the capacity to listen in this way.
Dave Isay wanted to give people a chance to tap into that capacity. So he came up with an idea for a project he called StoryCorps. In New York City, where he lives, he set up a small recording booth in a terminal at Grand Central Station. And he encouraged people to just step inside and interview each other.
I just didn't know what was going to happen. I thought of like Jerry Springer moments and people killing each other in the booth. And like there were many lost like nights of sleep.
And just like in his early documentaries, Dave would not be heard in any of those recordings from the booth. It would just be a couple of people telling their own stories. All Dave did was come up with a list of suggested questions for them to ask.
How do you want to be remembered? What are the most important lessons you've learned in life? You know, is there anything that you've never told me that you want to tell me now? And it's the kind of questions that kind of draw you together that are the kind of questions that get asked in StoryCorps.
I mean, this is not easy, right? Like, you need so much concentration and effort to listen to someone answer those questions and to have a conversation like that.
That's right. That's what active listening is that you are completely tuned into what someone is saying, and you are listening, you know, with unbelievable intensity. And, you know, it's an opportunity to say everything you've always wanted to say and hear things you've wanted to hear from people who matter to you.
So we open this booth in one of the busiest places in the world and invite people to have this incredibly intimate conversation with another human being. I had no idea if it would work. But from the very beginning, it did. People treated the experience with incredible respect, and amazing conversations happened inside. I want to play just one excerpt from an interview recorded at that original Grand Central booth. This is 12-year-old Joshua Littman interviewing his mother, Sarah. Josh has Asperger's syndrome. As you may know, kids with Asperger's are incredibly smart, but have a tough time socially. They usually have obsessions. In Josh's case, it's with animals. So this is Josh talking with his mom, Sarah, at Grand Central 9 years ago.
From a scale of 1 to 10, do you think your life would be different without animals?
I think it would be an 8 without animals, because they add so much pleasure to life.
How else do you think your life would be different without them?
I could do without things like cockroaches and snakes.
Well, I'm okay with snakes as long as they're not venomous or like can constrict you or anything.
Yeah, I'm not a big snake person.
But cockroach is just the insect we love to hate.
Yeah, it really is.
Did I turn out to be the son you wanted when I was born? Like, did I meet your expectations? And
you've exceeded my expectations, sweetie, because, you know, sure, you have these fantasies of what your child's going to be like, but you have made me grow so much as a parent because you think...
Well, I was the one who made you a parent.
You were the one who made me a parent. That's a good point. But also because you think differently from, you know, what they tell you in the parenting books.
Yeah.
I really had to learn to think out of the box with you. And it's made me much more creative as a parent and as a person. And I'm so lucky to have you as my son.
So this experiment in Grand Central worked, and we expanded across the country. Today, more than 100,000 people in all 50 states and thousands of cities and towns across America have recorded StoryCorps interviews. It's now the largest single collection of human voices ever gathered.
That collection is kept at the Library of Congress, and anyone who records a StoryCorps interview can choose to add their recording to that collection, so that one day, their children or grandchildren or anyone who's interested can look it up and listen.
I've also learned so much from these interviews. I've learned about the poetry and the wisdom and the grace that can be found in the words of people all around us when we simply take the time to listen. Like this interview between a betting clerk in Brooklyn named Danny Peraza, who brought his wife Annie to StoryCorps to talk about his love for her.
You see, the thing of it is, I always feel guilty when I say I love you to you, and I say it so often. I say it to remind you that as dumpy as I am, it's coming from me. It's like hearing a beautiful song from a busted old radio. And it's nice of you to keep the radio around the house.
If I don't have a note on the kitchen table, I think there's something wrong. You write a love letter to me
every
morning.
Well, the only thing that could possibly be wrong is I couldn't find a silly pen.
To my princess, the weather out today is extremely rainy. I'll call you at 11:20 in the morning.
It's a romantic weather
and
report.
And I love you, I love you, I love you.
When a guy is happily married, no matter what happens at work, no matter what happens in the rest of the day, there's a shelter when you get home. There's a knowledge, knowing that you can hug somebody without them throwing you downstairs and saying, get your hands off me. And being married is like having a color television set. You never want to go back to black and white.
It takes some courage to have these conversations. StoryCorps speaks to our mortality. There's a hospice doctor named Ira Byock who's worked closely with us on recording interviews with people who are dying. He wrote a book called The Four Things That Matter Most, about the four things you want to say to the most important people in your life before they or you die. Thank you. I love you. Forgive me. I forgive you. They're just about the most powerful words we can say to one another. And often that's what happens in a StoryCorps booth. It's a chance to have a sense of closure with someone you care about. No regrets, nothing left unsaid, and it's hard, and it takes courage. But that's why we're alive, right?
Dave Isay recently came up with a new idea to give anyone, anywhere in the world, that same chance to record an interview with someone they care about.
My name is Amber, and I am 29 years old, and I'm speaking with Ava, who is my daughter. How old are you, Ava?
4.
This recording came from a new StoryCorps app.
Basically, I said I want to try to see if we can
take StoryCorps and put it on a cell phone so that people can do this anywhere, anytime.
Can you describe your dad for me?
My dad is in the Army. He is deployed in Afghanistan, so we hope he comes back soon.
What do you think your future holds?
My future holds my family.
Just like StoryCorps, the app has suggested questions, and anyone who records an interview can choose to upload it to the Library of Congress.
Like, one of the total shocks has been seeing what's happened with the app. And, you know, we've had thousands and thousands of stories coming in, and people are listening and having this experience.
Hi, my name is Javier Bastos, April 29th, Sunday.
And Dave says something really interesting and unexpected is happening with the app.
And I'm going to interview myself regarding my recent illness.
People interviewing themselves, a kind of audio selfie.
And we're seeing a lot of them.
Do you think about dying? To be truthful, it's something that I know it's inevitable, and you know it's going to happen.
There's a guy who's sitting in a hospital bed. He's been diagnosed with some kind of cancer.
But at the same time, I accept it.
And he's just talking into the phone for his family.
Maybe I'll share this with my kids or my wife. They are the soul, the heart of who I am.
I mean, in a sense, it's like people are almost feeling listened to just talking into the phone, into the app.
Exactly, yes. And also the fact that it goes to the Library of Congress, they know that it will be listened to and that future generations can listen to it.
So here is my wish, that you will help us take everything we've learned through StoryCorps and bring it to the world. Imagine, for example, a national homework assignment where every high school student studying U.S. history across the country records an interview with an elder over Thanksgiving so that in one single weekend, an entire generation of American lives and experiences are captured. Or that people in your community go into retirement homes or hospitals or homeless shelters or even prisons armed with this app to honor the people least heard in our society and ask them who they are, what they've learned in life, and how they want to be remembered. Ten years ago, I recorded a StoryCorps interview with my dad, who was a psychiatrist and became a well-known gay activist. I never thought about that recording until a couple of years ago, when my dad, who seemed to be in perfect health and was still seeing patients 40 hours a week, was diagnosed with cancer. He passed away very suddenly a few days later. It was June 28th, 2012, the anniversary of the Stonewall riots.
What do you think is the most important thing that you've accomplished in your life? What are you proudest of?
I'm very proud of you kids. I am very proud of the work I've done. And I am proud of being able to turn my life around and make it into a happy and good one.
You think about dying?
All the time.
I listened to that interview for the first time at 3 a.m. on the day that he died. It was at that moment that I fully and viscerally grasped the importance of making these recordings.
And you'd never done this. You'd never sat down with him and asked him questions about his life in this way?
No, that's the beauty of StoryCorps.
Yeah.
Because, so you have the formal reason to go and have these conversations. And I think most people who record StoryCorps interviews don't necessarily listen to them until there's a reason to listen to it.
Every day, people come up to me and say, I wish I had interviewed my father or my grandmother or my brother, but I waited too long. Now, no one has to wait anymore. Interview a family member, a friend, or even a stranger. Together, we can create an archive of the wisdom of humanity. Maybe these conversations will remind us what's really important. And maybe, It will help us recognize that simple truth that every single life matters equally and infinitely. Thank you very much.
Dave Isay, who won this year's TED Prize. That prize helped make the StoryCorps app possible. And you can find that app in the amazing StoryCorps podcast at StoryCorps.org. Hey, thanks for listening to our show on listening this week. Our production staff here at NPR includes Jeff Rogers, Brent Bachman, Megan Kane, Neva Grant, and Janae West, with help from Barton Girdwood, Daniel Shukin, and Eric Newsom. Our partners at TED are Chris Anderson, Julie Cohen, Darren Triff, and Janet Lee. This episode is dedicated to the memory of our colleague and friend, NPR's Jim Lesher, who passed away this week. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.